My scalp prickled again. Shalu was standing on his hind legs by the bed, resting his elbows beside me. He and the llama looked at me, then at each other, both chuckled. Both chuckled, I swear it.
Lobsang, said my guide, you know there is no death, you know that upon leaving Earth at so-called death the ego goes to that plane where he or she rests a while before preparing to reincarnate in a body which will afford opportunities for learning other lessons and progressing ever upwards. Here we are in a plane from whence there is no reincarnating. Here we live, as you see us now, in harmony, at peace, and with the ability to go anywhere at any time by what you would call superastral traveling. Here animals and humans, and other species too, converse by speech as well as by telepathy. We use speech when close, and telepathy when distant. In the distance I could hear soft music, music which even I could understand. My tutors at the Chakpurai had lamented long over my inability to sing or make music. Their hearts would have been gladdened, I thought, if they could have seen how I enjoyed this music. Across the luminous sky colors flitted and wavered as if accompanying the music. Here, on this glorious landscape, the greens were greener, and the water bluer. Here were no trees gnarled by disease, no leaves with blight upon them. Here was only perfection. Perfection. Then what was I doing here? I was painfully far from perfect, as I well knew. You have fought the good fight, Lobsang, and you are here, for a holiday and to be encouraged, by right of attainment. My guide smiled benevolently as he spoke. I lay back, then started up in fright. My body, where is my earth body?
Rest, Lobsang, rest, replied the llama. Rest and we will show you much when your strength is greater. Slowly the light in the room faded from golden to a restful purplish haze. I felt a cool, strong hand placed upon my forehead, and a soft, furry paw rested in the palm of my right hand, and I knew no more. I dreamed that I was again upon earth. I gazed down, emotionless while Russian soldiers raked through the ruined troop carrier, pulling out burned bodies and bits of bodies. I saw a man look up, and point. Heads turned upwards in answer to his gestures, and I looked as well. There was my broken body teetering across the top of a high wall. Blood was running from the mouth and nostrils. I watched while my body was removed from the wall and placed in an ambulance. As the car drove off to a hospital, I hovered above and saw all. My silver cord was intact, I observed, it glistened like blue morning mists in the valleys. Russian orderlies pulled out the stretcher, not being particularly careful. Joltingly they carried it into an operating theater and rolled my body onto a table. Nurses cut off my blood-stained clothes and dropped them in a refuse bin. An X-ray unit took photographs, and I saw that I had three broken ribs, one had perforated my left lung. My left arm was broken in two places, and my left leg was broken again at the knee and at the ankle. The broken end of a soldier's bayonet had penetrated my left shoulder, narrowly missing a vital artery. The women surgeons sighed noisily, wondering where to start. I seemed to float over the operating table, watching, wondering if their skill would be great enough to patch me up. A gentle tugging upon my silver cord, and I found myself floating up through the ceiling, seeing in my passing, patients in their beds in wards above. I drifted up and away. Out into space, out among the limitless stars, beyond the astral, through etheric plane after plane, until I reached again the land of the golden light. I started, trying to peer through the purple mist. He has returned, a gentle voice said, and the mists receded, giving way to the glorious light again. My guide, the Lama Minya donned up, stood beside me, looking down. Shalu was lying on the bed beside me, gently purring. Two other high personages were in the room. When I saw them, they were looking out of the window watching the people strolling many feet below. At my gasp of surprise they turned and smiled upon me. You have been so very ill, said one, we feared that your body would not endure. The other, whom I knew well in spite of the exalted position he had had on earth, took my hands between his. You have suffered too much, Lobsang. The world has been too cruel to you. We have discussed this and feel that you may like to withdraw. There would be very much more suffering for you if you continued.
You can abandon your body now and remain here through eternity. Would you prefer it so? My heart leapt within me. Peace after all my sufferings. Sufferings which, but for my hard and special training, would have ended my life years ago. Special training. Yes, for what? So that I could see the aura of people, so that I could influence thought in the direction of auric research. And if I gave up, who would continue that task? The world has been too cruel to you. No blame will attach to you if you give up. I must think carefully here. No blame, from others, but throughout eternity I would have to live with my conscience. What was life? Just a few years of misery. A few more years of hardship, suffering, misunderstanding. Then, provided I had done all I could, my conscience would be at peace. For eternity. Honored sir, I replied, you have given me my choice. I will serve as long as my body will hold together. It is very shaky at this moment, I added. Happy smiles of approval broke out among the assembled men. Shalu purred loudly and gave me a gentle, playful bite of love. Your earth body, as you say, is in a deplorable condition through hardship, said the eminent man. Before you make a final decision, we must tell you this. We have located a body in the land of England, the owner of which is most anxious to leave. His aura has a fundamental harmonic of yours. Later, if conditions necessitate it, you can take over his body. I nearly fell out of bed in horror. Me take over another body? My guide laughed. Now Lobsang, where is all your training? It is merely like taking over the robe of another. And at the passing of 7 years the body would be yours, molecule for molecule yours, with the self-same scars to which you are so attached. At first it would be a little strange, as when you first wore Western clothes. I well remember that, Lobsang. The eminent man broke in again, you have your choice, my Lobsang. You can with a clear conscience relinquish your body now and remain here. But if you return to Earth, the time of the changing of bodies is not yet. Before you decide, I will tell you that if you return, you will return to hardship, misunderstanding, disbelief, and actual hatred, for there is a force of evil which tries to prevent all that is good in connection with human evolution. You will have evil forces with which to contend. My mind is made up, I replied. You have given me my choice. I will continue until my task is done, and if I have to take over another body, well, so be it. Heavy drowsiness assailed me. My eyes closed in spite of my efforts. The scene faded and I lapsed into unconsciousness. The world seemed to be spinning round. There was a roaring in my ears, and a babble of voices. In some way that I could not explain, I seemed to be tied up. Was I in prison again? Had the Japanese caught me? Was my journey across Russia a dream? Had I really been to the land of the golden light? He is coming to, said a rough voice. Hey! Wake up! Yelled someone in my ear. Drowsily I opened my aching eyes. A scowling Russian woman stared into my face. Beside her a fat woman doctor glanced stonily around the ward. A ward? I was in a ward with perhaps 40 or 50 other men. Then the pain came on. My whole body came alive with flaming pain. Breathing was difficult. I could not move. Or, he'll do, said the stony-faced doctor as she and the nurse turned and walked away. I lay panting, breath coming in short gasps because of the pain in my left side. No pain-relieving drugs here. Here one lived or died on one's own, neither expecting nor getting sympathy or relief from agony. Heavy nurses stomped by, shaking the bed with the weight of their tread. Every morning callous fingers tore off the dressings and replaced them by others. For one's other needs, one had to depend on the good offices of those patients who were ambulant and willing. For 2 weeks I lay there, almost neglected by the nurses and medical staff, getting what help I could from other patients, and suffering agonies when they could not or would not attend to my needs. At the end of 2 weeks the stony-faced woman doctor came, accompanied by the heavyweight nurse. Roughly they tore the plaster off my left arm and left leg. I had never seen any patient treated like this before, and when I showed signs of falling, the stalwart nurse supported me by my damaged left arm. During the next week I hobbled round, helping patients as best I could. All I had to wear was a blanket, and I was wondering how I would get clothing. On the 22nd day of my stay in the hospital, two policemen came to the ward. Ripping off my blanket, they shoved a suit of clothes at me, and shouted, "Hurry, you are being deported. You should have left 3 weeks ago." But how could I leave when I was unconscious through no fault of mine? I argued. A blow across the face was the only answer. The second policeman loosened his revolver in its holster suggestively. They hustled me down the stairs and into the office of the political commissar. "You did not tell us, when you were admitted, that you were being deported," he said angrily. "You have had treatment under false pretenses and now you must pay for it." "Comrade commissar," I replied, "I was brought here unconscious, and my injuries were caused by the bad driving of a Russian soldier. I have suffered much pain and loss through this." The commissar thoughtfully stroked his chin. "HMM," he said, "how do you know all this if you were unconscious? I must look into the matter." He turned to the policeman and said, "Take him off and keep him in a cell in your police station until you hear from me." Once again I was marched through crowded streets as an arrested man. At the police station my fingerprints were taken once more, and I was taken to a cell deep below the ground level. For a long time nothing happened, then a guard brought me cabbage soup, black bread and some very synthetic acorn coffee. The light in the corridor was kept on all the time, and there was no way of telling night from day, nor of marking the passing of the hours. Eventually I was taken to a room where a severe man shuffled his papers and peered at me over his glasses. "You have been found guilty," he said, "of remaining in Russia after you had been sentenced to be deported. True, you were involved in an accident not of your making, but immediately you became conscious you should have drawn the attention of the hospital commissar to your position. In your treatment you have cost Russia much," he went on, "but Russia is merciful. You will work on the roads in Poland for 12 months to help pay for your treatment. But you should pay me," I answered hotly. "Through the fault of a Russian soldier I have been badly injured. The soldier is not here to defend himself. He was uninjured, so we shot him. Your sentence stands. Tomorrow you will be taken to Poland where you will work on the roads." A guard roughly grabbed my arm, and led me off to the cell again. The next day I and two other men were taken from our cells and marched off to the railway station. For some time, in company with the police, we stood around. Then a platoon of soldiers appeared, and the policeman in charge of us went to the sergeant in charge of the soldiers and presented a form to be signed. Once again we were in the custody of the Russian army. Another long wait, and at long last we were marched off to a train which would eventually take us to Lwów in Poland. Lwów was a drab place. The countryside was dotted with oil wells. The roads were terrible because of the heavy war traffic. Men and women worked on the roads, breaking stones, filling in holes, and trying to keep body and soul together on a starvation diet. The two men who had traveled from Kiev with me were very dissimilar. Jacob was a nasty-minded man who rushed to the guards with any tale he could trump up. Joseph was different altogether and could be relied upon to pull his weight. Because my legs were bad and made it difficult for me to stand for long, I was given the job of sitting by the side of the road breaking stones. Apparently it was not considered that my damaged left arm and barely healed ribs and lungs were any drawback. For a month I stuck at it, slaving away for my food only. Even the women who worked were paid 2 zloty for each cubic yard of stone they broke. At the end of the month I collapsed, coughing blood. Joseph came to my aid as I lay by the roadside, ignoring the command of the guards. One of the soldiers raised his rifle and shot Joseph through the neck, fortunately missing any vital part. We lay by the side of the road together until a farmer came by in his horse-drawn cart. A guard stopped him and we were tumbled roughly on top of his load of flax. The guard jumped up beside him, and we trundled off to the prison hospital. For weeks I lay on the wooden planks that served as my bed. Then the prison doctor said that I would have to be moved out. I was dying, he said, and he would get into trouble if any more prisoners died that month. He had exceeded his quota. There was an unusual consultation in my hospital cell. The prison governor, the doctor, and a senior guard. "You will have to go to Strij," said the governor. "Things are not so strict, and the country is healthier. But governor, I replied, why should I move? I am in prison for no offense, for I have done no wrong at all. Why should I move and keep quiet about it? I will tell everyone I meet how it was arranged. There was much shouting, much bickering, and at last, I, the prisoner, came up with a solution. Governor, I said, you want me out to save yourselves. I will not be shunted to another prison and keep quiet. If you want me to remain silent, let Joseph Cochino and I go to Strigi as freemen. Give us clothes that we may be decent. Give us a little money that we may buy food. We will remain silent and will go right away over the Carpathians. The governor grumbled and swore, and all the men rushed out of my cell. The next day the governor came back and said that he had read my papers and saw that I was a man of honor, as he put it, who had been jailed unjustly. He would do as I said. For a week nothing happened, nothing more was said. At 3 o'clock on the morning of the 8th day a guard came into my cell, roughly awakened me, and told me I was wanted at the office. Quickly I dressed and followed the guard to the office. He opened the door and pushed me inside. A guard was sitting inside with 2 piles of clothing and 2 Russian army packs. Food was on a table. He motioned me to be silent and come to him. You are being taken to Strid, he whispered. When you get there ask the guard, there will be one only, to drive you a little farther. If you can get him on a quiet road, overpower him, tie him up and leave him by the side of the road. You have helped me with my illness, so I will tell you that there is a plot to shoot you as escapees. The door opened and Joseph came in. Now eat your breakfast, said the guard, and hurry up. Here is a sum of money to help you on your way. Quite a large sum it was, too. I could see the plot. The prison governor was going to say that we had robbed him and escaped. With breakfast inside us, we went out to a car, a 4-wheel drive Jeep type. A surly police driver sat at the wheel, revolver on the seat beside him. Curtly motioning to us to get in, he let in the clutch and shot out of the open gate. 35 miles on our way, 5 miles from Strid, I thought it was time to act. Quickly I reached over and did a little judo push under the guard's nose, with the other hand taking the steering wheel. The guard toppled, foot hard on the accelerator. Hastily I switched off and steered the car to the side of the road. Joseph was watching open-mouthed. Hastily I told him of the plot. Quick, Joseph, I said. Off with your clothes and put on his. You will have to be the guard. But Lobsang, wailed Joseph, I cannot drive, and you do not look like a Russian. We pushed the guard out of the way and I got into the driver's seat, started the engine, and drove on until we reached a rutted lane. We drove along a little way and stopped. The guard was stirring now so we propped him up. I held the gun at his side. Guard, I exclaimed as fiercely as I could manage, if you value your life you will do as I say. You will drive us around the outskirts of Strig and onto Skoli. There we will let you go. I will do anything you say, whimpered the guard, but if you are going to cross the border, let me cross with you, or I shall be shot. Joseph sat in the back of the jeep, carefully nursing the gun and looking with considerable longing at the back of the guard's neck. I sat by the driver, in case he should try any tricks such as running off the road, or throwing away the ignition key. We sped along, avoiding the main roads. The countryside became more hilly as we moved up into the Carpathian Mountains. The trees became denser, providing better hiding places. At a suitable spot we stopped to stretch our legs and have some food, sharing what we had with the guard. At Velkberezny, almost out of petrol, we stopped and hid the jeep. With the guard between us we moved stealthily along. This was border country, and we had to be careful. Anyone who has sufficient reason can cross the border of any country. It merely calls for a little ingenuity and enterprise. I have never had the slightest real trouble in crossing a frontier legally. My only difficulties have been when I had a perfectly legitimate passport. Passports merely inconvenience the innocent traveler, causing him to be subjected to ridiculous red tape. Lack of a passport has never hindered a person who had to cross frontiers. However, presumably there have to be passports in order to harass harmless travelers and give work to hordes of often very unpleasant officials. This is not a treatise on how to cross frontiers illegally, so I will just say that without difficulty the three of us entered Czechoslovakia. The guard went his way, and we went ours. My home is at Levice, said Joseph. I want to go home. You can stay with me as long as you like. Together we made our way to Kosice, Volyn, and on to Levice, walking, getting lifts, and riding on trains. Joseph knew the country well, knew where to get potatoes or beets or anything which could be eaten. At long last, we walked up a mean street in Levice to a small house. Joseph knocked, and as there was no reply, knocked again. With extreme caution, a curtain was drawn aside an inch or so. The watcher saw and recognized Joseph. The door was flung open and he was dragged inside. The door slammed in my face. I paced up and down outside. Eventually the door opened again and Joseph came out looking more troubled than I had thought possible. My mother won't have you in, he said. She says there are too many spies about and if we have anyone else in, we may all get arrested. I'm sorry. With that he turned shamefacedly away and re-entered the house. For long moments I stood dazed. I had been responsible for getting Joseph out of prison, I had saved him from getting shot. My efforts had brought him here, and now he had turned and left me to manage the best way I could. Sadly I turned and retraced my way down the street and on the long road again. No money, no food, no understanding of the language. I marched on blindly, saddened at the treachery of one I had called friend. For hour after hour I plodded along by the side of the highway. The few passing cars gave me not a glance, there were too many people on the march for me to attract attention. A few miles back I had assuaged my hunger somewhat by picking up some half-rotten potatoes which a farmer had put out for his pigs. Drink was never a problem, for there were always the streams. Long ago I had learned that streams and brooks were safe, but rivers were polluted. Far ahead of me on the straight road I saw a bulky object. In the distance it appeared to be a police truck, or road blockage. For several minutes I sat by the side of the road watching. There was no sign of police or soldiers, so I resumed my journey, being very cautious about it. As I drew near I saw that a man was trying to do something to the engine. He looked up at my approach and said something which I did not understand. He repeated it in another language, and then in another. At last I could roughly understand what he was saying. The engine had stopped and he could not make it go. Did I know about motors? I looked, and fiddled about, looked at the points, and tried the starter. There was ample petrol. Looking under the dash at the wiring I saw where the insulation had worn away, cutting off the ignition when the car had hit a bump in the road and jolted to bare wires together. I had no insulating tape or tools, but it was merely the work of moments to wrap the wires in strips of cloth and tie them safely. The engine started and purred smoothly. Something wrong here, I thought. This engine goes too well to be an old farmer's car. The man was hopping up and down with joy. Brava, brava! He kept exclaiming. You have saved me. I looked at him in some puzzlement. How had I saved him by starting his car? He looked me over carefully. I have seen you before, he said. You were with another man, and you were crossing the Riverton Bridge at Levice. Yes, I replied, and now I am on my way alone. He motioned me to get into the car. As he drove along I told him all that had happened. By his aura I could see that he was a trustworthy and well-intentioned man. The war ended my profession, he said, and I have to live and support my family. You are good with cars and I can use a driver who will not get stuck on the road. We take foodstuffs and a few luxury articles from one country to another. All you have to do is to drive and maintain a car. I looked very dubious. Smuggling? I had never done it in my life. The man looked at me and said, no drugs, no weapons, nothing harmful. Food to keep people alive, and a few luxury articles for women to keep them happy. It seemed peculiar to me. Czechoslovakia did not appear to be a country which could afford to export food and luxury goods. I said so, and the man replied, you are perfectly correct, it all comes from another country, we merely forward it on. The Russians steal from the occupied peoples, taking all their possessions. They put all the valuable goods on trains and send back loads of stuff to high party leaders. We merely intercept those trains which have the most good food, which we can direct to other countries who are in need. All the frontier guards are in it. You would merely have to drive, with me beside you. Well, I said, show me in this truck. If there are no drugs, nothing harmful, I will drive you to wherever you wish. He laughed and said, come on in the back. Look as much as you want. My regular driver is ill, and I thought I could manage this car myself. I cannot, for I know nothing of mechanical things. I was a well-known lawyer in Vienna before the war put me out of work. I rummaged, and turned out the back. As he said, there was only food and a few silk things which women wear. I am satisfied, I said. I will drive you. He motioned me to the driver's seat, and we were off on a journey which took me through Bratislava, into Austria, through Vienna and Klagenfurt, and eventually into Italy, where the journey ended at Verona. Frontier guards stopped us, made a show of inspecting the goods, then waved us on when a little package was placed in their hands. Once a police car raced ahead of us, stopped suddenly, and caused me to really stand on the brakes. Two policemen dashed at us with drawn revolvers. Then, on production of certain papers, they backed away, looking very embarrassed and muttering profuse apologies. My new employer seemed to be very pleased with me. I can put you in touch with a man who runs trucks to Lausanne, in Switzerland, he said, and if he is as satisfied as I am, he can pass you on to someone who will get you to Ludwigshafen in Germany. For a week we lazed in Venice while our cargo was being unloaded and other goods put aboard. We also wanted a rest after the exhausting drive. Venice was a terrible place for me. I found it difficult to breathe in that lowland. It appeared to me that the place was merely an open sewer. From Venice, in a different truck, we went on to Padua, Vicenza, and Verona. Among all the officials we were treated as public benefactors, and I wondered who my employer really was. From his aura, and the aura cannot lie, it was obvious that he was a good man. I made no inquiries, as I was not really interested. All I wanted was to get going, to get on with my own task in life. As I knew, my task could not start until I could settle down, free from all this jumping from country to country. My employer walked into my room in the Verona Hotel. I have a man I want you to meet. He is coming here this afternoon. Ah, Lobsang, you would do better if you shaved off your beard. Americans seem to dislike beards, and this man is an American who reconditions trucks and cars and moves them from country to country. How about it, sir? I replied, if the Americans or anyone else dislike my beard, they will have to go on disliking. My jaw bones were shattered by Japanese boots, and I wear a beard to disguise my injuries. My employer talked with me for quite a time, and before we parted he gave me a very satisfactory sum of money, saying that I had kept my part of the bargain, he would keep his. The American was a flashy individual, rolling a huge cigar between his thick lips. His teeth were liberally studded with gold fillings, and his clothes really dazzled with their gaudiness. Dancing attendance upon him was a very artificially blonde woman whose clothing scarce concealed those portions of her anatomy which Western convention decreed should be covered. "Sir, eh?" she squealed as she looked at me. "Isn't he cute? Isn't he a doll?" "Oh, shut it, baby," said the man who provided her income. "Scram, go take a walk. We got business." With a pout and a jiggle that shook everything dangerously, and placed a heavy strain on flimsy fabric, Baby flounced out of the room in search of drinks. "We gotta get a swell Mercedes out," said the American. "No sale for it here, it will fetch plenty money in another country. It used to belong to one of Musso's big shots. We liberated it and painted it over. I got a dandy contact in Karlsruhe, in Germany. If I can get it there, I stand to make a packet." "Why do you not drive it yourself?" I asked. "I do not know Switzerland or Germany." "Gee, me drive it? I have done it too often, all the frontier guards know me." "So you want me to get caught?" I replied. "I have come too far, too dangerously to get stopped now. No, I do not want this job. Or, man. It's a cinch for you, you look honest and I can provide papers saying that it is your car and you are a tourist. Sure, I can give you all the papers." He fished in a large briefcase which he was carrying, and shoved a whole sheaf of papers and forms at me. Idly I glanced at them. Ship's engineer. I saw that they referred to a man, a ship's engineer. His union card and all were there. Ship's engineer. If I could get those papers, I could get aboard a ship.